is the last talk, but not the last class, in the series on the five spiritual faculties. Next week will be the final discussion on this particular topic tonight, and tonight's topic is wisdom. Wisdom. You might say that the crescendo of the talks kind of meet in this last talk, wisdom. Because as you might remember, we're practicing insight meditation. Insight is that direct revelation that leads to wisdom, that is wisdom. Insight is wisdom. And the other faculties, the other qualities that nurture that are the other four spiritual faculties that we have been talking about. And they all work together harmoniously, almost in sync. Not the pop group, but one of the ways I want to address wisdom tonight is to talk about how it is fostered by the other four, and it becomes really just different perceptions of the same hologram. And wisdom is the perception of is the actual perception itself, the seeing itself. And the others kind of create the landscape or the foundation for seeing to occur. You might say that faith is the willingness to perceive something new. Mostly we don't have that willingness. We hold ourselves fast to what we know, and we defend ourselves against anything that might change ourselves significantly, or that we would have to change, or would have to alter our particular sense of security. And much of our defenses are built around keeping ourselves in place. In place. And somehow, mystery itself, that gets kind of dull. I mean, that's not a mystery, but the fact that we get tired of the dullness is somewhat of a mystery. And we are actually willing to perceive something new. Now, the willingness is faith. The perception of seeing something new is wisdom, you see? First, we have to be willing. And how are we going to be willing? Well, we have to first release ourselves from that which seems to be holding us back, which is the effort. We have to observe. We have to bring the quality of observation in. Nothing's going to be seen unless our eyes are open, and I mean our internal eyes. That's mindfulness. And the whole frame has to be steady enough so that we can see, and that's samadhi. Right? Okay. So those are the five faculties. Faith, effort, mindfulness, samadhi, and wisdom. And our practice, the secret teaching of our practice, is that behind the scenes, that's what's being cultivated. That's what's happening. As we sit, hopefully relaxed, which already creates an environment of ease so that we're not in turmoil or stress. And then we bring forth the effort to release ourselves from thought. That's the effort. And to sustain our attention upon something. That's the concentration. And then we observe what it is that we're seeing. That's the mindfulness. And then we're willing not to just stay with what we're seeing, but to look through all of the opinions and investments we have in whatever we're seeing and see it anew. The willingness is faith, and the perception is wisdom. That's the practice. Beautifully laid out, actually, not by me, but by the Buddha. Footnote down there. So you might say that the willingness to perceive, right, is before the perception itself. Faith is before wisdom. You have to have the willingness. You have to be unstuck, you might say, in order for the perception to occur. So faith precedes wisdom. Isn't that interesting? Because mostly we think what we see, then we can have faith in. But it also works that way. It fosters when you see, then it informs the ego of what you're seeing, a new perception, an aha experience. And that allows you to relax the tenacious way we control and hold on to our own neediness and our own self-absorbed perceptions. And the willingness to release a little allows more faith. That is the more faith, which allows more perceptions to occur within that ease, which on and on it goes, you see? So it fosters each other. Each feeds the other. So wisdom and faith work hand in hand. The more we see, the more we're willing to risk. The more we're willing to risk, the more we see. So the practice is very much about having the willingness to risk. And you see how complacency and habit create the defenses from that risk occurring. And if the risk doesn't occur, neither does the insight. And we are very determined to maintain ourselves and have insight. We're very, we try. I mean, that's really the whole of the practice, is that we want to be informed. But we don't want to give up much. We want to be in place all along this path. And we want to be informed. Yeah, I want the wisdom. But just don't let it affect me. Well, it can't help but affect us. When we genuinely release, willing to risk, we're vulnerable and open. That is the environment for wisdom to occur. We have to be vulnerable and open. When wisdom occurs, we change. It's not, I'm going to ruminate about this change, whether I want you change. You see it. When you see it, you can't go back to the old defense anymore. It doesn't work. I mean, we try, and it works for a while, but it's like the last roar of a dying lion. Sounds ferocious, but it's on its way out. So the habit patterns can't sustain the wisdom factor. Can't sustain it. So it's interesting. And wisdom is something we intimate has something to do with experience or life, it being informed by life. Have you ever sat down with your grandmother when you were young, or grandfather? And just the age itself is an attraction to you. You're just drawn to the person, sometimes because of the quality of character that age has allowed, but sometimes because you just want to know what it was like when they were young. You know, what was it like not having cars or whatever? What we're trying to get at is not so much their memories as how their life, the wisdom in there, how life has transformed itself and the change that occurs. And often we have a particular perception of what wisdom looks like. The wise owl surveying the landscape, or the wizened old man with beard, or the monk. I was a new monk in Thailand, and I really wasn't. I've never been too attached to ritual. It's fine. It has its place, but it's never been a major part of my own practice. So, as a new monk, I wasn't really interested so much in learning the ritual aspects of the form. And yet, the lay people expect that from you. Well, I was always I was so young as a monk that my turn never came up to have to do anything ritualistically, and all these more senior monks always did that, so I was well protected. But once I ventured away from our monastery, because I just wanted to get alone and sit, do some retreating out on an island, and so I was going far away from my monastery on an island, and I was the only monk walking along, and I think I slept out or something that night with a mosquito net. Next morning, villagers started coming all around me and bringing food, offering. My heart just sank, because there's a whole ritual way that a monk says the precepts and says a whole bunch of Pali words and before they get the food. So I was, I couldn't figure a way out. So I thought, oh, this is going to be, anyway. So they all came and offered their food, and then the lay person asked in Pali for me to offer them the precepts, which I kind of heard a few times because I was in the background, but I had not memorized. And so but they were expecting, Westerner. They didn't know how long I'd been a monk, and I couldn't speak enough Thai to communicate it. And so they were, this was their message of wisdom right there. And I remember mangling the first precept hopelessly, switching the second and third precepts, forgetting the first half of the fourth precept, and being so distraught, forgetting entirely the fifth precept. And they were, they had done this 1,000 times in their life and knew everything that was missing and mangled, and yet were very reverential and very, and thanked me. But I got a first-hand knowledge that the appearance of monks didn't necessarily mean that there was anything back there of any substantial quality. But we sometimes look for that, don't we? We look for appearances to as guides towards whether there's wisdom or not. And yet wisdom, the definition is that when somebody moves from wisdom, when there's movement out of the out of wisdom, it's spontaneous, it's natural, and it's not in any way characterized in a certain way. You can't say this is a mark of wisdom. Perhaps the only mark of wisdom you could say is non-reactivity. That's just about the only one. Nothing. I don't think there's another way that you could tell. So what is wisdom? Well, wisdom is the willingness to see what's on the other side of fear and desire. Usually those are the blinders that keep us packaged within the known and safe universe we live in. And the willingness to pierce or to go through desire or fear and to see what's on the other side of it, to come through that, to see what is on the other side of the mirror image. You see, desire and fear you can think of as like a mirror in front of you. It only reflects back what your mind is craving. So you see from the universe what your mind is craving, and we look out and we see our own reflection. We listen and we hear our own voice. And the willingness to move through desire and fear so that wisdom is available on the other side of that. Seeing something new. Direct perception of wonder. The direct perception of wonder. That's wisdom. And if we just move in with what we're desiring or our habits say, there's no sense of contact with that wonder. And we all crave it. Our hearts long for the wonder of life. In fact, it's the wonder is the heart. To say it longs for it is once we have moved through our tendencies to approach or avoid something and just move right through it, the heart comes into full fruition within wonder. And that's wisdom. That's where wisdom, everything is seen as new and under. It's not as if, for a long time, our practice is about trying to understand things. You know, and it feeds the sense of me, the understanding, because once the insight occurs, then there is a kind of a background knowledge that this is the way life is. And the background knowledge can become a kind of detriment to further understanding. It becomes knowledge. It becomes the way we see life, which fixes another whole view and another whole reference for us. So it's not that wisdom is what we know about life. It's the active seeing of life. Immediate. In the present, not in the past. And at some point, you don't really care whether you understand or not. Not in terms of the background intellect. That's not what's important. And for a while, it's very helpful to understand things and to get a sense of that and to pursue and investigate and look and understand more. Because that all allows the ego to relax a little bit and release its grip, as I mentioned before, have a little more faith and a little willingness to venture out and to risk a little further. Which is very important to the whole practice. But at some point, it's living the wonder. It's abiding in faith. Abiding in it. Living the wonder is living wisdom. Living wisdom. Not having wisdom. And to constantly reference what we know about life is to have wisdom. Oh, he's wise. Do you see? Now, another way, a way that you can practice is wisdom comes from non-avoidance. Non-avoidance. If you don't like it, start turning towards it. The rule of thumb. Whatever you don't like, start moving in the direction of just allowing it to touch you, to be felt. Because it's the avoidance that keeps us within the confines of our fear. So move towards what you seem to avoid. Simple enough. Let it become a cue for you. Let the avoidance, the opposition, the turning away, become a cue for you, like a light. It goes, oh, stop here. Pause. Move towards this. Move towards it. Let me touch this thing. And as we move more and more towards what we are naturally want to move away from, we're moving against or antithetical to the sense of self itself, to the sense of me. The sense of me builds upon wanting to avoid, seeking nicer environments than the one I'm in, turning away from. That's how I become embodied as me. And if I can turn towards what I want to avoid, but rather than that I start, you know, aligning myself to it, then I am going towards anatta rather than atta, towards selflessness. Because you can't face something you don't like for very long and not see the reasons you don't like it. What you want from the world and all of the things that you really want that aren't there. Which is the noise of our mind. See, we create all this noise about things through our wanting them or not wanting them, which is the whole sense of embellishment and embodiment of me. I don't like that, I like this. So when we're willing to face something and hear the noise but not follow the script of that noise, then we're moving in the right direction. Doesn't mean you have to eat your spinach. But you have to just be aware that you're trying to avoid it and feel the unpleasant qualities associated with it and the temptation to flee. And then whether you eat it or not is up to you. But you get a sense of it. You get a sense of the hold it has on us. The hold it has on us is only the mind's projection onto that thing. It doesn't contain that intrinsically itself. And that hold it has on us is our past history with it, which is my whole sense of history with it, which is the whole sense of me with it. So if I move with what it tells me about it, I'm moving with the me, with my history, with everything that I've disliked about it, and I'm just going to follow that track once more and deepen the groove of that conditioning. Gets me nowhere except further into the mire of my own habit. You know, when I was working with the hospice program, sometimes I would come to a family, and I don't know what made the difference between one family and another, but every once in a while you'd hit a family in which the caregiver and the dying patient were really working towards learning deeply about this phase of their life, and you could feel the wisdom grow in their willingness to not avoid this precious opportunity and chance that they had at the end of their life. And death being what it is has so much of a hold and an avoidance issue with it, so much fear associated with it, that the wisdom that can be is directly proportional to the amount of fear we have with about something. Because the more fear we have in relationship to something, the deeper the entrenched groove and habit we have in turning away, and the more that can be understood if we just face it. And I don't know what makes the difference. I mean, I don't know why, and you can feel it in the elderly sometimes, a person who has used their life to deepen the depth of their understanding, maybe never having been a meditator, probably never having been a meditator, but somehow that life's tragedies, the unavoidable circumstances of life, were faced, and that you can feel the depth of the character, the depth of the stillness in them, and the depth of their wisdom. Another person, same age, perhaps similar tragedies, would be cynical and bitter, and you wouldn't feel any wisdom in them at all. So life's circumstances, aging, can bring wisdom. It just isn't a certainty that it will. But if you have one thing that most people don't have, that is your observation. That is the mindfulness. That's the other spiritual faculty, mindfulness, and your willingness to attend to those circumstances, whether you like them or not. doesn't matter. Just your willingness to attend through them. Not to come out smiling and shining and feeling like you weren't battered. That's not the point. But that's just your willingness to attend. That's all you need for wisdom to deepen. Just your willingness to attend. In family situations, in your own health problems, in the traumas of everyday living, just your willingness to attend to it, to bring as much awareness in, not to have to do it right, not to go through the traffic jam without honking your horn, not to go through the traffic jam allowing everybody to get in front of you, not to go through the traffic jam and not be selfishly motivated, not to go through it in a certain way, but to go through it in awareness, with awareness. Because awareness will show everything, will show you all the landscape. It's not to be a good girl or a good boy in the middle of a traffic jam. It's to be an aware person. To be aware. Oh, I can't stand this anymore. That's okay. The reactions are okay. Let them be as they will. Just you keep the ability to attend. And not to become bitter from what you attend to. Not to become cynical around that. To use it for your learning. And then your life will be straight on course. The other thing that most people don't understand about wisdom, they think, I'm not sure where they think it comes from, but the Buddha said wisdom comes through reading, writing, listening, speaking, meditating, reflecting. So that's about everything we can do. I mean, I've had many examples of when I'm talking have insights as I'm speaking. Perhaps you have them while you're listening. I have many times have insights while I'm reading something. It depends on the quality of the mindfulness and attention that we give, whatever it is, that we're, and our genuine openness, our faith, our willingness to change in that. It's said in the Buddha's time that he would give a sermon and hundreds of monks would be awakened within the words of the sermon. It's only because of their willingness to open, to be open to the words, to allow the words to affect them, to be willing to change. That's faith. You see how each one of these feed the other. So I want to just suggest to you that you don't pass over any of those as useless forms of worldly life, but rather they can be, it depends on what you read and how you read it, or what you hear and how you listen to it, can be access the door of insight. And now let me just talk about reflection for a moment, because we don't usually consider reflection as a form of insight. But one very renowned Buddhist monk, Ajahn Sumedho, senior Western monk in the Ajahn Chah tradition, has spent much of his adult life reflecting. And he said that most of his insight has come through that reflection. It's not that we have to do everything wrong in order for us to have experienced the wisdom of that transgression. You can look out and reflect upon how life is for other people and see that and accrue wisdom from those kinds of reflective attitudes. Huh? You can just see how people's lives are. Just be reflective. Just look at them. Not judgmentally. If you're judgmental, you aren't seeing how they are. You're seeing from your sense of opinion and discrimination. So you just want to look and say, oh, I see how that works. And then you can bring that to bear upon your own life, and you can not have to do it, for one thing. Save you a lot of time. But again, mostly what we do when we look out is to hold a kind of judgment Because what we're not so interested in gleaning the wisdom that's out there. We're interested in holding our positions in relationship to somebody who's acting stupid. And I feel better than they. That's what we're really interested in, is one-upmanship. And no wisdom will be accrued when there's the sense of me as the predominant force within our observation. You see? Now, I just want to talk for a moment about how and what ignorance is, so that you can get a sense of what wisdom is. The mind, the consciousness, in its purest form, is, might say, pristine awareness, without anything contaminating it. The direct cognizing of something. It's when you listen to something, knowing what's occurring, knowing that sound is occurring, is the cognizing, the knowing quality, not the intellectual knowing of what that sound is. That's a thought. But the fact that it is occurring, the cognizing quality, is consciousness. Now, usually our consciousness is laden with hindrances. Hindrances being, you know, I don't want to have the five hindrances. Desire and fear, sleepiness and restlessness, and doubt. And permutations. 58 permutations, or however many aspects of, I don't know. But there are a lot of different permutations of that obscure that pristine quality. Now it's not obscured anymore. For a moment it was. And now, what we call, when the consciousness, which is in its natural state, pristine, when it's clouded with hindrances, we call this ignorance. We call it ignorance. In traditional Buddhist lingo, those are defilements. I don't particularly like the word ignorant. I don't like ignorance, and I don't like defilements, and I don't like hindrances, because they're all seem to indicate something bad and wrong with life. But what it does mean is that we have grabbed a hold of those mind states at the expense of the greater awareness and pristine quality of consciousness itself, and have lost our identity within those mind qualities of wanting and not wanting, or I'm sleepy and I hate this and I'm restless about all of that. You just get pushed around. And there's no wisdom that can be had within a mind that is full of its attached worry and concern. But the good news is that defilements are not intrinsic. They're visitors. All mind states are visitors in this pristine awareness. Here's Ajahn Buddhadasa, my teacher in Thailand, said this: the original mind is luminous. Mind may appear original, but isn't genuinely pure when it is pure only for a period of time that nothing constricts it. In such times, it is temporarily luminous. Once it is shaped within conflict repeatedly and long enough, wisdom begins to manifest and grow weary of the tolerating of this constricted struggle. Consequently, it gets smarter in using the knowledge it has accumulated, so itself returns to the luminosity of a lasting kind. That is, it becomes completely pure once more, never again defiling itself, in everlasting purity. So what is our relationship if wisdom is where the path is directed and the defilements and the hindrances seem to be what obscures it? What should be our relationship to the defilements so that we can get back to the purity? Fair question? Because all of us carry around these kind of defilements all the time. Now, since they're visitors, it's an important thing to remember that they're not something in themselves. They're not permanent states of mind, although we treat them often like they're permanent. I'm going to be sleepy forever. I'm always self-doubting. The sense of me keeps referencing those things as if they've always been with us. But what in your mind has ever been with you all the time? Nothing. Nothing. Not even the sense of I, although it's been pretty continuous. It's not there in deep sleep. And we just keep saying, the problems I have when I sit down, all of these things that obscure it, and he says it's pure. There's some purity. I don't see anything pure in this sleepiness, restlessness, wanting, hatred, blah, blah, blah. So what should be our relationship to those? Remember, if we follow them, we simply strengthen the sense of me, right? We're just following our old reactive patterns to these hindrances as they arise, to these defilements as they occur, and I get stronger in my determination, in my will, in my control to force them out, to be pristine, to find that pristine, right? We go, right? We get bigger muscled. Makes you have very little tolerance internally or externally, that mode. But remember that wisdom comes through non-avoidance. So first we have to know they're occurring. Can't do this unconsciously. Lights have to be on, right? The second thing is that what we're looking at, the defilement or the hindrance, has to be steady enough so that I can see it. Listen to the five faculties. The third thing is I have to be willing to release all my antagonism for this thing and my desire to run away from it and be willing to face it. Effort. The fifth thing is I have to be willing to know myself in its absence. Faith. That last step may be the most difficult. Especially, I see sometimes people come with incredible accumulation of self-pity. Their sense of self is built around having these hindrances and how labor-intensive they are and how awful. And they just love being who they are as a pitiful person. Now, we have to be stronger than that. We have to be wiser than that. I can't have any self-reference to these things. I'm always sleepy. My practice is forever bound in sleepiness. This will never work. I can't do... That all has to... There it is. No self-referencing, no turning away. To do so, I'm just reinforcing the defensiveness, building myself up, reinforcing and the hindrance through my aversion to it, my fear of it, and it'll come back stronger next time because the additional fear will be there in my next relationship, in my next contact. Anger, loneliness. You see, wisdom is the willingness not to avoid. And you access wisdom through non-avoidance. So what are we going to do here? How are we going to access wisdom? There's the steadiness, there's the awareness, there's the willingness to release myself from the opinions just to face it. There's my willingness to go through it, which is faith. All of those things together in their nurturing and maturity, the point is right there, and then I don't do anything. And when I don't do anything, I see it for what it was. It was a breeze, a puff of wind. It was a creak from an unoiled door. It was a faraway call of a crow. It was nothing. It was just so many ashes. And we will never know that unless all five faculties are working sufficiently. And most importantly, our willingness not to take on this hindrance with a personal representation of me, my sleepiness, my this, my that. Because in the my, I'm turning away and reinforcing its whole hold on me and reinforcing the ignorance and defilement that the mind is creating. Just be. This is it. But what I do in order to keep myself on track with just me is I create all the noise I have about all these things, all the stories I have. Something comes up like sleepiness. Oh, it's been with me ever since I was. My doubt. Oh, I've had doubt when I was a little kid. I can tell you all about my doubt. I couldn't get through third grade without my teacher. And it was that full of, you know, we have stories about everything. All those stories create the noise of the thing itself. We love the embellishment of the story because they keep us feeling very full and satisfied. They keep the ignorance very dark and defensive. And no wisdom can penetrate the purity into the purity of mind. The purity of mind seems as if it's impenetrable with all the noise. Not only will all the noise keep me feeling strong and embodied, but it also doesn't allow my mind to steady itself in samadhi. It doesn't even allow me to observe what's there. I'm just following the noise of what's there, the story of what's there. So there's no mindfulness, there's no samadhi, there's no willingness to go beyond, there's no faith. There's no effort because I like the story. I'm not making any effort to get out of it. And certainly there's no wisdom. You see the five faculties? I want you to see the five faculties. I want you to really understand that this practice is in creating that internal rest, that internal ease of well-being that lives wisdom, embodies wisdom, abides in wisdom, abides in faith. You know, death comes, Mary Oliver poem says. Then I remember death comes. Death comes before the rolling away of the stone. I have to die in order to enter a new relationship with something. And all hope, all presence, not hope, all presence is on the other side of the story, of the embellishment. And that's where the practice takes us. And that's where there's life, true resurrection, the true resurrection. All of this rolling away the stone and the crucifix, all of that is symbolic for the true resurrection. Life on the other side. Of my objections to it, of my avoidance. It is there we rest. Can we sit for a minute or two?